history is the first battlefield. And so often we see that the enemies of the gospel have been busy trying to rewrite history and in order to steal from us our Christian heritage. It's vital that we know our history, that we understand that history is his story. And one of the great figures in African history is David Livingstone. I've done a lot in studying Livingstone, and our mission headquarters in Cape Town is Livingstone House. We've got a lot of Livingstone's original books and first editions and maps and pictures at our mission headquarters. And we're inspired because of what Livingstone stood for. He was a reformed Christian. He had a vision of victory. He was missions-minded. He came into Africa, and he was the first to preach the gospel in many parts of Africa. He opened Africa up for the gospel, and he fought the Islamic slave trade. He set many captives free. We think he's a good example and inspiration for us today. So Livingstone, the liberator. This is a statue at Victoria Falls, on the Zimbabwe side of Victoria Falls, which he named and first made known to the world. David Livingstone was a great missionary pioneer, pathfinder, whose greatest desire was only granted to him after his death. And that was the ending of the slave trade and the opening up of Africa to Christianity and lawful commerce. He had the grace to see that his mission was part of a divine plan to set many souls free from slavery, both physical slavery and spiritual slavery. And this was largely achieved through the work of his convert, the American journalist Henry Morton Stanley, who's a remarkable person for many reasons, one of which is that he fought on both sides of the Civil War in America. Extraordinary what journalists will do to get a story. And he came to Africa not to write Livingstone's stories, but to destroy Livingstone's character. He came, he said, like a hunter looking for Livingstone in his sights. He wanted to prove this man a hypocrite and destroy his reputation. And his whole vision was to undermine the credibility of Livingstone. But after crossing half the continent and then meeting him, he was, as he said, one of Livingstone's converts. When someone said Livingstone was a useless missionary, he had no converts, Stanley said, I'm one of his converts. And this man, the cynic, the skeptical secular journalist, was one of the more prominent converts of David Livingstone's extraordinary ministry. David Livingstone was brought up in a pious but poverty-stricken home in Scotland. His was one of 16 families living in this tenement, and each family had one room. That was for the whole family, one room, and they had to share one kitchen for all the 16 families and so on. He was brought up in a very poverty-stricken situation. He was an avid reader, though, and he borrowed extensively from the local library. This is a model of his home in Livingstone Museum in Zambia. By age 9, he had already committed to memory Psalm 119, which, if you didn't remember, is the longest psalm, the longest chapter in the Bible, very long. But it's all about the Word of God. And as a reward, he won a copy of the New Testament. And by age 10, David was employed 14 hours a day, 6 days a week at the local cotton spinning factory. Now, how many of us have worked that hard from age 10 to 20? The same boring, tedious, menial task. This is a picture of the kind of cotton mill he would have worked on. And here's one of those who'd balance a book on part of the machinery. And as he dashed to and fro, he'd snatch a sentence here and then. This is how he maintained study while working. This is the Blantyre Cotton Mill, the spinning works in Scotland, where Livingstone worked during his childhood. And this is the medical school where he studied medicine back in the early part of the 1830s. David managed to read in the factory by placing a book on a portion of the spinning journey, so he snatched sentence after sentence as he passed about his work. And with a roar of machinery, he maintained some kind of constant study. He was converted to Christ at age 12. And he was inspired to resolve to devote his life to the alleviation of human misery. And the book that he said that influenced him more than any other was Real Christianity by William Wilberforce, who of course was getting to the end of his ministry by the time that Livingstone was beginning his. And it's interesting, this passing of the torch, what William Wilberforce achieved in England, Livingstone desired to achieve in Africa. And he took it even further. That's why he is so dedicated to fighting the slave trade, because of Wilberforce's influence to him through books. Don't underestimate the power of books. Three themes dominated his life: evangelization, exploration, and emancipation. And he wrote at the time that the salvation of men ought to be the chief desire and aim of every Christian. He therefore made a resolution that he would give to the cause of missions all that he might earn beyond what was required for his subsistence. And he hardened his body. He decided to do without luxuries, you know, like sugar in his tea. And he'd sleep on the ground to prepare himself for missions in Africa. He denied himself all kinds of legitimate, what you wouldn't even consider luxuries, because he wanted to harden himself for missions. He had a very resolute mind. After 10 years of daily drudgery at the cotton mill, David set out to study theology and medicine. Medical science in the 1830s was, by today's standards, primitive. Here you can see his surgical case, which included the saw for amputations. Surgical operations were performed at hazardous speeds because there was no anesthetics at that stage. It was a matter of bind them down, put a piece of leather in it between teeth to bite and hold them while we saw or whatever it is. I mean, very primitive surgery at that time. Chloroform and ether were not introduced till several years later, and the discovery of antiseptics lay 25 years ahead of his studies. The study of chemistry was growing, but physics had hardly started, and biochemistry and bacteriology were unknown. Nothing at all was known about the tropical diseases he was to encounter, very, very personally, up close, such as malaria and blackwater fever, and he suffered fevers over 30 times in his lifetime. It was not in Livingstone's character to relax. He took his task and his calling most seriously. And whatever he did, he performed thoroughly. He was uncompromising, diligent, and inflexible in his inheritance, in his adherence to his word. Friends described him as a man of resolute courage. Water, fire, stone wall would not stop Livingstone in the fulfillment of any recognized duty. And one of the examples is how he walked a large distance in Scotland to repay something like 4 cents, 4 pennies, that he had borrowed from somebody. He just was inflexible to fulfill his duty. It took him 3 months by sailing ship to reach Cape Town from England, another 4 months by ox cart before he reached Robert Moffat's mission at Kuruman, where he began his work for the Lord in Africa. That's 7 months to get to the field. You know, if we have to travel 7 days, or even 7 hours, we're not that happy about, but 7 days we'd think is a phenomenal amount of traveling. 7 months just to start his work. And he's already had 10 years in the cotton mills, years of study. And by the way, you might be interested to know that the first sermon that he preached, he stood up, his mind went blank, he fled from the pulpit in confusion, and the London Missionary Society said, this man has no chance whatsoever of ever being a missionary, and he's got no leadership skills, and he's a useless speaker. And so they rejected his first application to the London Missionary Society. If anyone's ever failed at something, be encouraged. David Livingstone did not do very well at the beginning, but he sure caught up later. When he landed in South Africa on the 17th of March, 1841, David Livingstone was coming to a continent that was plagued with problems. Here you can see some of his journeys, as you can see, marked up there. He literally walked from Port Elizabeth up to Botswana. He walked from Cape Town to Botswana. He walked across Botswana, Zambia, and Angola. He walked across Zimbabwe and Mozambique. He walked up across Tanzania. Now, when we have missionaries in Frontline Fellowship complaining about the old vehicles and the bad roads, I say, we drive where Livingstone walked. Talk about bad roads. There weren't even bridges at that time. He had to hack his way through dense jungle. He had to swim every river. There was no bridge anywhere across any of the rivers he had to cross in Africa. And he didn't have bottled water or purification tablets or purification systems. He had to drink the most vile type of water in the most difficult situations imaginable. So when somebody in our mission, you often get foreigners coming along and they ask, but is it in walking distance? And my answer is always, yes. Everywhere in Africa is in walking distance. David Livingstone proved that. The question is, do you have the time to walk? So, yes, everywhere is in walking distance. Africa, when Livingstone came, was still a place of mystery to the Europeans. And the Arabs south of the Sahara never ventured very far from the coast inland. The rivers were riddled with rapids and sandbars, which made traveling by river, which is what they do in America and Europe, the rivers are highways. But in Africa, our rivers do not generally allow that. The deadly malaria disease was widespread and it inhibited travel. There had been entire expeditions that the Portuguese had sent out of 300 to 400 men, which had been wiped out by malaria. Malaria didn't just decimate, it annihilated whole expeditions. The African terrain was difficult to negotiate. Floods, tropical forest swamps thwarted wheeled travel. Livingstone soon acquired a reputation for fearless faith, particularly when he walked to the Barka tribe, which had been infamous for the brutal murder of four white traders whom they mercilessly poisoned and strangled. And he went to preach to them. As the first messenger of mercy in many regions, Livingstone soon received further challenge. Chief Shashele pointed to the Great Kalahari Desert and he said, "You can never cross that country to the tribes beyond. It is utterly impossible, even for us black men." Well, that's a way to motivate Livingstone. Tell him it can't be done. The challenge of crossing this obstacle began to fascinate David Livingstone. Livingstone wrote, "I shall try to hold myself in readiness to go anywhere, provided it be forward." He is reported to have had a steadfast manner, in other words, he's blunt, and folk knew where they stood with him. Livingstone initially had the plan to establish a Bible college for Africans, and this was frustrated. The missionaries at that time didn't foresee in any foreseeable future that black people would be leading their own churches. And Livingstone was ahead of his time saying, of course they can. Once we've discipled them, they will be able to teach churches. But he was heavily criticized by fellow white missionaries for having such confidence in the leadership abilities of the local converts. However, the sovereignty of God still seen in his frustration, because had Livingstone's wishes been carried out, he might have spent his whole life training in a Bible college rather than traversing Africa, opening up Africa for the gospel and dealing a death blow to the Islamic slave trade. So, yes, he had a good plan, but God had an even better plan for him at that time. His three great daily challenges he described as heat, harsh conditions, and hardness of hearts. We still have some of those problems. "I hope to be permitted to work as long as I live beyond other men's line of things and plant the seed of the gospel where others have not planted it. But every excursion for that purpose will involve separation from my family for periods of 4 to 5 months. Now, David Livingstone had been attacked by a lion. In fact, I wouldn't blame the lion. Livingstone had got suckered into going to shoot a lion, which some local tribes said had been hunting their goats, which is highly unlikely. They probably just wanted to get rid of the lion anyway. And, of course, lion skins were very much what the chiefs wanted. Anyway, Livingstone got into a fight that was none of his business, and he shot this lion, wounded it, and the lion came and ripped his shoulder, broke his bones. He was in a very poor state, and he could have died from this entirely. And I've had some people saying to me how, you know, well, you see the lions attacked David Livingstone. I said, well, Livingstone shot the lion. I mean, the lion didn't attack Livingstone while he's minding his own business. But all the same, while he was recuperating from these very severe wounds, he met Mary Moffat, the daughter of Robert Moffat, and that's how they got to know one another, and they ended up being married. Here you can see Livingstone's arm bone, which was identified, clearly identified as him, after he had died and they had brought his body back to England, and that's in the museum in England. Livingstone said, "I am a missionary, heart and soul. God had an only son, and he was a missionary and a physician. A poor, poor imitation of him I am, or wish to be. But in his service I hope to live, and in it I wish to die." That's the kind of resolution of this man. This is a recreation of the meeting where Robert Moffat gave his speech in England. It was interesting that David Livingstone had been planning to be a missionary to China. He hadn't thought of Africa. He was wanting to be a missionary to China. And his whole course was deflected. And Robert Moffat, who is the first missionary to translate the entire Bible into an African language, the Tswana language. The Botswana people are very blessed to be in the first nation in Africa to have the full Bible translated into their language. I think Botswana is a very stable, peaceful, blessed nation as a result of the impact of Robert Moffat's ministry and this Bible. But Robert Moffat was in England, and he spoke at a London Missionary Society meeting, which was attended by David Livingstone as a young theological student. And he spoke of the smoke of 1,000 villages that have not yet heard the message of Christ. And Livingstone was so gripped by this message, he shifted his focus from China to Africa. Praise God he did. Imagine if Livingstone had gone to China and Africa had missed having this man to serve us. Here's a recreation picture of Mary Moffat teaching Sunday school at Kuruman, back before she would have been married. This was Victorian era, early photography, where they were having people who looked like it or descendants, and they tried to recreate some of these pictures. This is an actual portrait of David Livingston. The way they would do it is it was early photography, and they'd touch it up again with a pen, but it was some of the early photographic evidence of David Livingston and of his wife Mary Moffat. This would have been after his first missionary journey back in the 1850s. A drawing of David Livingston's initial reception by Chief Shinty on his first missionary journey after he dropped his wife off in Cape Town to go back to England. During his first missionary journey with his wife and children, their fourth child, Elizabeth, was born, but within a few weeks she had died and the rest of the family were sick. And you can imagine when he came back with his ox cart into Kuruman to his in-laws with sick wife, sick children, one of the grandchildren dead, he came in for severe criticism for the irresponsibility of taking a wife and four children on a missionary journey in the wilderness. Later, when he sent his family back to Britain, while he pioneered the hinterland of Africa, he was criticized even more severely for abandoning them. When his wife rejoined him for a second great missionary expedition in the Zambezi Valley, she died of malaria, and he was criticized for taking her there. So basically, he couldn't do anything right in the eyes of his critics. "I shall open up a path into the interior, or I will perish," he said. "May God bless us and make us blessings even unto death. Shame upon us missionaries if we are to be outdone by slave traders." You can see one of the occupational hazards of crossing a river with a hippo banging the canoe. Livingston said, "If Christian missionaries and Christian merchants could remain throughout the year in the interior of the continent, in 10 years, slave dealers would be driven out of the market." He documented how some parents sold some of their children for just a packet of needles. And that's why he said we must open up the gospel, the continent of Africa, for the gospel and for lawful commerce. Because he saw that the Arabs were able to trade with people for their, even their own children or their neighboring tribes that had been kidnapped, because the people wanted what was being offered. And he said, but if the people could see, they've got so much more to trade than human flesh. They don't have to trade their flesh and blood. They can trade in so many other things. And so he wanted to get Christian merchants in, recognizing that to defeat Islam in the slave trade, because of human greed, you needed something more than the gospel presentation. You also needed Christian economics. You needed the free market as well and Christian work ethic. He battled rains, chronic discomfort, rust, everything metal rusted, everything of fabric rotted in the rain. Totally drenched and fatigued, laid low by fever, Livingston continued to persevere across the continent. Through rainforest, through desert, hostile tribes demanded exorbitant payment for crossing their territory. You know, I used to think when I got to Mozambique, Angola, Congo and other places, and people would demand exorbitant customs dues and visa fees and all this rubbish, I thought, this is the fruit of colonialism. Here the people have picked this up and have just made it worse with all the paperwork. But I discovered I'm wrong. This is inherent to Africa. They might have added paper because of the colonials, but there's always been payment for crossing people's territories. David Livingston had people behind carrying bales on their heads. That wasn't because Livingston lived a comfortable lifestyle. He didn't. Most of what the people were carrying was for payment to cross people's territory. Fabric, cloth, beads, mirrors, all sorts of things. In fact, by the time he reached Luanda on his first missionary journey to get across Zambia to Angola, he didn't even have shoes. He was walking barefoot. He'd even had to give his boots away. He was unshaven because even his razor and his mirror had to be traded in order to cross different chiefs' territory. Some tense moments were stared down by Livingston, gun in hand. Trials tested the tenacity of his travel-weary team. This is a stamp that came out in 1973 in Zambia, under the Kaunda regime of all people, who is definitely not pro-British, pro-white or anything like that, but It was commemorating the death of David Livingstone in 1873 in Zambia, and so Zambia published a 10 naira stamp of Livingstone chasing the Muslim slave traders out of Zambia. And it had his quote, "Heal this open sore," which was his great call for people to fight the slave trade. So even a socialist, humanist, communist like Kenneth Kaunda had to recognize the unmatched work done by David Livingstone. And let me remind you that just about every city in Africa named after some European has been renamed. Stanleyville, Elizabethville, Salisbury, those names have been changed, but nobody's going to rename Livingstone or Livingstonia. And that's an honored name, even in countries that are hostile to everything else that might have come from Britain. But they do love David Livingstone. "Can the love of Christ not carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the slave trader?" Livingstone challenged. And here you can see in Livingstone Museum a map showing some of the places where Livingstone walked across Africa. I mean, from coast to coast, continent to continent. I just drove on a 9,000 kilometer journey up to Zambia and back on good roads in a good vehicle. And that was tiring. Now imagine walking a whole lot more than that. Now, Victoria Falls is forever associated with Livingstone's memory because he was the first foreigner to cite and to make known to the world the Victoria Falls. Now, in the past, people would say, "Could Livingstone discover Victoria Falls? Goodness me, people lived there all the time. He couldn't have been the first person to see it." Well, actually, he might well have been the first person to see it, because the local people, while they knew about something there, the noise, the mist that went so high, people called it Musi Oyatanya in the area, the smoke, the thunders. But no one dared go near there because the witch doctor says it is an enchanted place. It's a place of Nyami Nyami, the great river god. And no one was allowed to go near there. And no one could have seen it. And because there's no description, oral, written, drawing, anything of the Victoria Falls before Livingstone's hand-drawn oil painting of this. Because of that, it's quite possible nobody had even seen the Victoria Falls or even knew that there was a waterfall. They just knew there was something very noisy. And when he came into the area, he immediately noticed this place is a paradise for wildlife because the animals there had never been hunted. And he said how the herds of buffalo and other wildlife there was just phenomenal, huge amounts of elephant there as he got closer. And so he could well have been the very first person to see the Victoria Falls, but he certainly was the first to name it, to sketch it, and to make it known to the world. And when I went up there recently looking at this magnificent site, and this is where Livingstone would have approached, and he crawled to the edge on what's now called Livingstone Island to gaze down at this most phenomenal site. Here you can actually see a model of Victoria Falls. The water comes down. Now you can see here, this number 17, that's what's called Livingstone Island. He came down on a canoe, and he stopped there, just as well he stopped, then crawled to the edge of what's now called Livingstone Island for a look at this mile-wide, 300-foot-high waterfall, the greatest waterfall in the world. And this is a spectacular sight. I've seen Niagara Falls, not bad, but it doesn't compare to Victoria Falls. On the Zimbabwe side, you've got David Livingstone's statue. This was erected on the anniversary of his birth. And on the Zambian side, there's a new one that's erected on the 150th anniversary of his sighting of the Victoria Falls. They put this up in 2005. So David Livingstone's memory is still very precious in Zambia, Zimbabwe, Malawi, where his name and his statues are well revered. After 2 years of pining across the hinterland of Africa, Livingstone reached Luanda. The forerunner ship was ready to take him to England. However, Livingstone chose to return overland to bring his guides and porters back to their village in what would today be Botswana. Now that's an extraordinary thing. Why did he do that? Because although he had missed his family and he could get in his boat and he could be in England in a couple of months, but the porters were now in Portuguese West Africa, and the Portuguese still had slavery. And he was afraid that they might be captured and enslaved, so he knew he could protect them, and he wanted to take them back to the villages. He knew this meant he'd be away from his family at least another 2 years. But the sense of honor was he left the ship, and he gave a copy of his diaries onto the ship, and he, rather than risk them being sold into slavery in Portuguese West Africa, he preferred to take another 2 years crossing the continent that had almost killed him on his first journey. However, had Livingstone chosen to return, he might well have ended his ministry, because the ship sank with all hands lost and with all of his journals. But by God's grace, Livingstone has still had a copy of his journals. He had laboriously written out. Remember, there's no photocopy shop. He had laboriously handwritten a copy of all of his measurements, scientific measurements on readings. This is, for example, his cross-section of the continent, which he laboriously, day by day, was taking his readings and sightings and recording it. Even when he was sick with malaria, he kept this up so that he provided the first understanding, scientific, geographic understanding of the continent of Africa. But imagine, if he had taken the easy way and taken that ship, he would have ended his ministry there. Isn't that an interesting insight? These privations, I beg you to observe, are not sacrifices, he wrote. I think that word ought never to be mentioned in reference to anything we can do for him, who though he was rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. Often Livingstone endured excessive and unnecessary suffering and deprivation, hacking through dense jungle on foot because lack of funds prevented him the luxury of affording a canoe. I wouldn't have thought a canoe is luxury, but you can imagine. Livingstone lived very poor in Scotland, and he lived even poorer in Africa. He was not a man who enriched himself. And when I've heard people speaking against the missionaries, I remember one of the first missions conferences I ever went to, Dr. Nico Smit, Dutch Reformed Church missiologist from Stellenbosch University, who's actually a liberation theologian, really, and friend of the ANC and the Marxists. He said the missionaries came to Africa and taught that black people had no souls and they were the firewood of hell. Now, I was a brand new Christian. I knew nothing about anything. I mean, I was very new Christian. But I stood up in a plenary session and interrupted Dr. Smit at this Krugersdorp student consultation on world missions. And I said, excuse me, Germany Smit, who are you talking about? Did David Livingstone believe this? He said, no. I said, did Robert Moffat, did Mary Slessor? Who believed this? He said, well, many of the missionaries. I said, I don't understand. I mean, they were really getting irritated. I was having people trying to get me sit down. I said, I don't understand. If the missionaries didn't believe black people were souls for whom Christ died, why did they come to Africa? Didn't they die in Africa in their droves? I thought missionaries lasted in Africa a very short time. The life expectancy for a missionary in Africa was something around 2 years. Whole families are buried, and I've seen the graveyards of mother, father, children, all buried there in Malawi, all young. Missionaries in their 20s, young child, buried there. They died of malaria like flies. Why did the missionaries come to Africa if they didn't believe the people that they were serving were souls for whom Christ died? What outrageous slander that people like Dominie Nicholas Smith could just try to engender racial hatred and animosity by injecting this kind of fiction. Tripe. You could say that somebody believed it, but you can't tell me the missionaries believed that. Because what were they here for? Why did they suffer as they did? Some of them packed their belongings in a coffin, knowing that's only where they were going back to England. Livingstone often saw the sickening sights of the Islamic slave trade. He saw the burned out villages. He saw the corpses floating down rivers. He saw long lines of shackled slaves being herded through the bush. Livingstone's mere presence often sent the Yao slave raiders in Malawi scurrying into the bushes. Many hundreds of slaves were set free by Livingstone and his co-workers. On one occasion, a war party of Yao warriors attacked the missionary party. And while attempting to avoid confrontation, his team found themselves cut off and surrounded by the aggressive and bloodthirsty mob. And finally, Livingstone was forced to give the command to return fire. The slave traders fled. Here's a picture of David Livingstone's rifle and pistol in Livingstone Museum, and some of the knives and sword that were gifts of his that he owned. Livingstone was no pacifist, make no mistake. Now, this incident led to much criticism in England. Charles Livingstone, his brother, who normally was a critic of his brother, but on this occasion when hearing of the outburst in Britain, and let me just remind you, they may not have had guns that much in Africa, but they sure had a lot of other weapons, and the Muslim slave traders often had muskets. Charles Livingston said, if you were in Africa and saw a host of murderous savages aiming their heavily laden muskets and poisoned arrows at you, more light might enter your mind. And if it didn't, great daylight would enter your body through arrow and bullet holes. It's all very well for people to criticize back in England, but they weren't facing the reality. I mean, he had to see these people dragged off, their villages burning, being taken off to slavery. Of course he had to intervene. And yet, I'm sure he'd be criticized if he hadn't intervened, but because he did intervene, they criticized him anyway. It was Livingston's great desire to see the slave trade cease. Firstly, there was the internal slave trade between hostile tribes. Many tribes engaged in slavery. In fact, I've seen it. I've seen the Vemba people enslaving the Bushmen. I've seen the people in the Congo enslaving pygmies. I mean, this is going on today. This is nothing new. This is tradition. Secondly, there were slave traders from the coast, Arabs or Portuguese, for whom local tribes encouraged to collect slaves by marauding raids. This raid took place in 1884. And this is a long time after the days of Livingston. They were still raiding slaves in some parts of Africa. Thirdly, there were parties sent out from Portuguese and Arab coastal towns with cloth, beads, muskets and ammunition to exchange for slaves. So three slave trades, actually, that he exposed. And here you can see some of the migrations and some of the routes some of the slave traders were following even. And again, the Livingston Museum, they've got quite a lot about the fight against slavery and the road to freedom and all that was involved and some of what Livingston witnessed of the Muslims involved in Dar es Salaam in their slave trade. And slavery and ivory poaching went together. They'd often go and kill a whole lot of elephants and then catch a lot of slaves, and the slaves would carry the ivory back to the coast, they'd sell the slaves and sell the ivory, sort of double destruction, extra profit. And this is in the Livingston Museum in Lusaka. This is interesting. Here's a proclamation in the year of our Lord 1906. And this is from the King of Barutsiland. That's what you know as Western Zambia. Giving a proclamation that all slaves were to be set free in Western Zambia. 1906. Slavery is not totally extinguished yet. Livingston dealt it a death blow. But it still has continued even to this day in places like Sudan, where it keeps being revived by Muslims. But we need to recognize that there's an enormously more to slavery than what Wilberforce recognized and defeated in his battles in the British Empire, because every single country, nation, and religion was involved in it. And that's why it took people like Livingston to take it further, to expose all the other aspects of the slave trade. Yes, Britain had stopped their involvement, but that didn't stop everyone else's involvement. Some of the slave restraints used by Arab slave traders in Zambia, again on display in the Livingston Museum. These are some people in Zambia on their way to the coast, and this is in the 1890s this picture was taken, being dragged off to Muslim slavery that late. And these are slaves, these are three slave traders who were captured at Zanzibar as late as 1890 by the British. These people had been involved in Arab slave trade, helping them. Well, we all know about the famous meeting where Henry Morton Stanley hikes across Africa in the middle of Africa, just where Tanzania and the Congo meet at Ujiji. He sees another white man and he walks up to him very calmly and says, Dr. Livingston, I presume. It's just classic kind of understatement. Who else could it be? But here's a picture of David Livingston and Stanley reading newspapers and getting some of the news, which for Livingston was some of the first news he'd gotten in several years. It's extraordinary how Livingston was very popular in England after his first missionary journey. But after the second missionary journey, no one even wanted to see him, because he had been involved in so many different scraps with other white officials and missionaries over the slave trade who didn't like him, that they had destroyed his reputation, that when he came back to England for the second missionary journey, they wouldn't even talk to him. Nobody saw him arrive, nobody saw him leave. He just was yesterday's hero, forget about it. And it was up to the Americans to basically salvage him. And it was Stanley who made him world known and made his cause succeed. because the British had had enough of him after the second missionary journey. They didn't want anything to do with him because he had been harsh and he had spoken harshly and he had fired some of the people that were on his team because he's a strict, hard taskmaster. But they never heard his side of the story. They just heard the people who had deserted his Zambezi expedition team going back to England, giving more and more bad stories. By the time he got there, no one wanted to hear his story. Incidentally, David Livingstone inspired the shortest war in history. You can check in the Guinness Book of Records. Just after he died, the British Navy presented an ultimatum to the Sultan of Zanzibar to close the flourishing slave market. The British were so ashamed how they'd abandoned their leader, their explorer, their missionary, that when Stanley made known what he had done and that he, after he came back from his discovery of Livingstone, the British sent the Navy to go and shell the slave market at Zanzibar. And when the Sultan refused to surrender, his palace was shelled, resulting in a record-breaking surrender within the hour, and it's in the Guinness Book of Records as the shortest war in history. In his writings and public speaking engagements, David Livingstone regularly spoke of his twin concerns: to enlighten people on the evils of the slave trade and to spread the Christian gospel amongst the heathen. Those were his two main goals. Here you see his signature as well by that portrait. Although he was renowned for his exploration, in his mind, exploration was only a means to evangelism and to disciple the nations. Livingstone believed in comprehensively fulfilling the Great Commission. He ministered to body, mind, and spirit. And so along with his Bible and his surgical kit and his medicine chest, Livingstone always carried a microscope and a sextant with which he observed God's spectacularly diverse creation with awe and wonder. And his books are filled with fascinating scientific, medical, botanical, anthropological, geographic observations and details. For example, let me just show you some of the pictures that you get by Livingstone's own hand in his Livingstone's Travels, the book across his first missionary journey. And he shows different headdresses and beards that the local tribes had, and different musical instruments that people were using in the center of Africa, and the types of tools being used in the farming. And he shows how the people are engaged in activities. Notice the detail, such as the dog that's emaciated, the person carrying all those gourds, and the people filling the gourds, which in this case might be ostrich eggs even, filling them with water at the river. And the baobab trees, and how some people travel. All kinds of details are in his books. The double-handed Angolan hoe, where two people would use the hoe. Victoria Falls. Some of the people's dances and customs. All the detail that he wanted people to learn. The hippos, which were barely known in Africa, in Europe. And so he is detailing the different types of antelope that you would find in Africa. And the eland. All of that's in Livingstone's first book, all those sketches. And he is the first to map the great Zambezi River and other parts of the vast hinterland of Africa. Here you've got the Zambezi River being mapped, and he's got all the elevations and the height above sea level and all these details in there. And today when they take a satellite map and they compare it to his hand-drawn map on the ground, they say it's not far off. He's pretty on target. Extraordinary detail and precision. He was really a scientist as well. And that, by the way, you get in Livingstone's first edition book, which we've got, and we've got these maps at our mission house too. This is the newspaper, the New York Herald, that announced the discovery of David Livingstone in the center of Africa. So it's got Stanley's story, and it's got some of the map of Stanley from the distances and where he traveled to find Livingstone and so on. Here's the cross-section across southern and central Africa done by Livingstone in his travels in his first book, giving all the details and all the different climactic changes. This also from his first edition, and you can see the distances traveled and so on. He was one of the very first scientists to make the connection between mosquitoes and malaria. In fact, he was the first to make it popularly known. And he pioneered the use of quinine, which he picked up in Brazil, as a treatment, often experimenting on himself. Now, at that time, the scientific community was convinced malaria is caused by bad air. Solution to malaria: have high roofs, high ceilings so bad air can float to the top and you don't get malaria. They had no idea that it was caused by some insect like a mosquito biting you. And so Livingstone's the first who made the connection and made this known. And for years he was treating himself with quinine, surviving malaria, while other people was dying of malaria and not believing that his treatment was correct. And they weren't listening to him. It took years and years and years before the scientific community caught up with Livingstone and realized he is right, both in his diagnosis and in his treatment. Here you see the tsetse fly as well, which he drew, which of course, well, I've been bitten by these guys many a time. Tsetse flies are even more deadly than malaria and mosquitoes in many ways. The challenge of Livingstone rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. One mission organization wrote to David Livingstone asking, "Have you found a good road to where you are? If so, we want to send other men to join you." Livingstone replied, "If you have men who will come only if they know there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all." The optimistic eschatology of Livingstone, the liberator, comes as a stern rebuke to the prevailing escapist eschatology of defeat and retreat. The strategy of ministering to body, mind, and soul was enormously successful. Livingstone combined his medical training with theological education and a vision for establishing lay leadership Bible training centers throughout Africa to minister to body, mind, and spirit. His painstakingly detailed and accurate geographic research and map making on his pioneer explorations and his published research were foundational in opening up Africa to Christianity and to destroying the Islamic slave trade. He had the grace to see that his mission was part of a divine plan to set many souls free. And despite the crushing losses of his fourth child Elizabeth and his wife Mary to diseases in the field, despite many debilitating diseases and attacks by wild animals and Muslim slave raiders and criticism from home and the physical strain of hacking his way through dense tropical jungles, walking from coast to coast, he persevered. And he said, "Nothing earthly will make me give up my work in despair. I encourage myself in the Lord my God and I go forward." The tribulation so willingly endured by so many missionary pioneers should provoke us to ask, what could have inspired them to continue on in the face of such overwhelming obstacles and hardships? Livingstone wrote that we need to be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified. That holiness to the Lord might be engraved on the heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. We have still a debt of gratitude to Jesus, and there's no greater privilege on earth than after having our own chains broken off to go forth and to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to them that are blind, those that are bound. So David Livingstone was inspired by an optimistic view of the end times. Like most missionaries of the 19th century, Livingstone was a post-millennialist who held to the eschatology of victory. Discoveries and inventions are culminative, filling the earth with the glory of the Lord. All nations will sing His glory and bow before Him. Our work and its fruit are culminative. We work towards a new state of things. Future missionaries will be rewarded by conversions for every sermon. We are their pioneers and helpers. Let them not forget the watchman of the night who worked while all was gloom and no evidence of success in the way of conversions shares our path. They will doubtless have more light than we. But we serve our master earnestly and we proclaim the same gospel as they will do. So he recognized, yes, we're not getting a lot of conversions right now, but I'm plowing. I'm just preparing the way. Others will follow. They will reap where we have plowed. A quiet audience today. The seed is being sown. The least of all seeds now, but it will grow to a mighty tree. It is, as it were, a small stone cut out of the mountain, but it will fill the earth. He writes Daniel 2 in the margin. We work for a glorious future which we are not yet destined to see. The golden age, which has not yet been, but will yet be. We are only morning stars shining in the dark. But the glorious morn will break, the good time coming yet. So all that is from Livingston's journals. The dominion has been given by the power of commerce and population unto the people of the saints of the Most High. This is an everlasting kingdom, a little stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which shall cover the whole earth. For this time we work. By different agencies, the great ruler is bringing all things into focus. Jesus is gathering all things to himself. He is daily becoming more and more the center of the world's hopes and of the world's fears. His steadfast example has been used by the Lord to inspire hundreds of men and women to devote their lives to African missions. Here's the university mission with Bishop Mackenzie, who did a lot of work in Malawi, bringing many people to Christ there, and shooting a lot of Muslim slave traders, setting a lot of slaves free too. Mackenzie wrote back about his wonderful repeater rifle and how well it shot and how he is able to bring these slave traders down. Here's a very militant missionary. And here's Archbishop Mackenzie in his Church of England robes, without his rifle in this picture though. The steadfast example of Livingston has been used by the Lord to inspire hundreds of men and women to devote their lives to African missions. Here's a woodwork of Stanley parting from Livingston, and of Livingston being found on his knees praying in what is today northern Zambia. The woodwork carving on the tree by his men, Sousa, who marked his date of his death according to the diary that they had, and they planted his heart under the tree, buried his heart under the tree. They said his heart belongs in Africa, but they carried his body back to the coast, which took almost a year. It was a very hard, perilous journey for them. They said he's an important man, his body must go back to his own people. And here they've got the skin of the actual lion that attacked him, that Livingston shot. There's the many of his papers and journals and maps being examined by his relatives in England, with his two very faithful workers who carried his body back to England. And in Westminster Abbey, where they had the funeral in England, and the London News on front page document, how all of London stopped and came out to honour this great missionary explorer. Mary Slessor, for example, went to Calabar in what is today Nigeria and ended the practice of murdering twins who were believed by animists to be bewitched as a result of Livingston's example. Peter Cameron was inspired to return to Africa after his first mission failed and he had given up. And he read the inscription on the tomb of Livingston, Westminster Abbey, which I've read, and here's a picture of it. "Other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, them also I must bring." Do you see on the side? "Other sheep I must bring." That's written down the side of Livingston's tomb. That's right there in the floor of Westminster Abbey. And this just inspired Peter Cameron to go back to Africa and try again. And he's the one who founded Africa Inland Mission, which is one of the most successful missions in Africa. And the Africa Inland Church of Kenya, which is the biggest, came out of his work. The Livingston Museum in Zambia, just by the Victoria Falls. And another statue of Livingston at that museum. Notice his Bible in his hand. "I beg to direct your attention to Africa," Livingston said. "I know that in a few years I shall be cut off in that country, which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to try to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. It is for you to carry out the work which I have begun. I leave it with you." We've got a book on David Livingston, which was written by a contemporary at the time, a British Member of Parliament, which has been slightly revised for modern usage of language and different pictures added. I helped to edit. In the Greatest Century of Missions book, we've got a chapter on Livingston. And we've got different CDs, including a CD on David Livingston with a PowerPoint on this, although we're continually updating them. It's also in the Great Commission course, MP3. We've got articles on Livingston also on our website, on frontline.org.za. Are there any questions at all on Livingston or Christian view of history? We need to, of course, look at all the different great people of our history, and we're trying to do that in our Reformation Society. Look at people like Mary Slessor, Robert Moffat, many of these missionaries who came and made such a difference, and understanding our history better, because it's through stories and individuals like this that I think we can inspire the children. Any questions?
This is a contemporary question. on your picture of the Livingston Museum, there's an airplane.
Yes.
That airplane
was a Zambian Air Force plane. I think it was, and it's got the Zambian Air Force logo there. So that would have been when it was part of Northern Rhodesia, but then they put the Zambian emblem on too. So this would have just been probably a fighter or trainer plane that was part of the Northern Rhodesian Air Force, which later became part of the Zambian Air Force Independence. Mm-hmm. I couldn't identify the plane. It wasn't immediately obvious to me. It wasn't a Harvard, but it wasn't too different from a Harvard.
The Harvard, I think, had a regular engine. This is an inline engine, just a two-blade prop.
Yeah.
It's a very old plane.
I didn't recognize it. I mean, it wasn't a Spitfire Hurricane.
It was so much newer than what Livingston had.
Yes, I mean, right, yes. Plainly. Yes, the Livingston Museum's not just about David Livingston. It's a museum with all sorts of things. They've only got one hall about this size dedicated to Livingston there. We'd like to see a whole lot more, but they've got a lot of interesting things, original manuscripts and letters of his and so on. We are speaking with the Zambian government, see what we can do to really refurbish this and make it more of a creation museum and with a lot more Christian input in there.
That was what I wanted you to, if you were free to say, your burden to change that from an evolutionary museum to a creation museum.
Yes, off the subject of David Livingston, but this museum at the moment, shamefully, has a lot of evolutionary exhibits from the Kahunda era, 1960s and 70s, evolutionary propaganda, ape men, billions of years, all sorts of horrible stuff. And so we're speaking to the Zambian government, which espouses a Christian commitment that this is not consistent with either the nation's faith, as officially a Christian nation, or the name of David Livingston's a disgrace. That a museum named after him has got evolutionary ape men garbage in it. So we're speaking with them to put them in touch with Answers in Genesis, Ken Ham's Creation Museum in Cincinnati, to see if they can't get together and with help from Cincinnati get a top class 21st century high standard creation museum in there, and I think that can be done. So at the moment we've got some cabinet ministers in Zambia interested, listening, and please pray for the ongoing project there. This is, I think, a wonderful opportunity because Victoria Falls is the greatest natural spectacle in Africa. It's one of the greatest tourist attractions on the continent. And many people come to the museum. We saw a lot of people, backpackers and whole tour bus things at the museum when we were there. So plainly it would reach a lot of people. Imagine the evangelistic and discipleship impact of having at Victoria Falls a real creation museum.